Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll be talking to retired English professor Marianne Werner about her current favorite fiction and nonfiction books. Novelist Sharon Owens writes Amy Machado mysteries under the name Sharon St. George. Her earlier writing, including advertising copy, feature stories, a history of NASA's space food project, and three original plays. She occasionally acts in or directs one of her local theater productions. After working several years as director of medical staff services in an acute care hospital, she became interested in writing hospital-based mysteries. She serves as program director for Writers Forum, a nonprofit organization for writers based in Redding, California. Her mysteries are set in a medical center in the fictional Northern California town of Timbergate. She has so far completed three novels in the series, Due for Discard, Checked Out, and Breach of Ethics. Sharon Owens, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm happy to be here.
Now, in your first book, in your acknowledgments, you acknowledge your brother. And you say in your acknowledgments that you want to thank your brother, George, for his scrupulous attention to police procedure and investigative details. And in your books, your protagonist has a wonderful relationship with her brother.
Yes.
And I was wondering if the fact that you have a brother named George had anything to do with your choice of a pen name.
You know, that's an interesting story. When I was searching for an author name, I looked up my own name, Sharon Owen, and discovered that there was a Sharon Owen in Ireland who wrote romances, and there was a Sharon Owen in California who wrote nonfiction. So I started thinking, what can I do? What can I use that will mean something to me? My paternal grandparents are from the Azores, from the island of St. George. And as soon as that dawned on me, I said, okay, that's it. I've got it. My brother, who has been so helpful and whose name is George, loves to say, and she probably picked that name also because of our close relationship. So I'm just
so
kind
I'm not
of going
the first
to,
one to
no,
suspect that
no,
it had something to do with your dear
that's,
brother.
That's correct. So I say it's both. I have another brother, though, so I can't just play favorites completely.
Now, since you mentioned your connection to the Azores, which mm-hmm. is Portuguese speaking, mm-hmm. When I first picked up your book mm-hmm. and I looked down and saw your name, and then I saw that this book was an Amy, what I pronounced it was Machado mm-hmm. mystery. Mm-hmm. And then when I started reading the book, I found out, oh no, this is Portuguese. Mm-hmm. So her name is not pronounced the Spanish way,
that's
but
right.
Machado.
Machado, that's correct. Yes, yes. And I've made a point in each book very early on in the story to show the pronunciation, because writers are often warned that it's very distracting for a reader if you give a character a name that the reader isn't certain how to pronounce. And with Machado, I thought, oh, well, I'm using the name. It's a Portuguese name. I like that name for her. It kind of has a rhythm to it, Amy Machado. But I don't want my reader to be uncomfortable. So it sneaked in a way to let the reader know the correct pronunciation of her name all the way through. And for every other name in the entire series, I've been careful to choose names that do not need
explanations,
that's
for
right.
For how to pronounce.
That's right.
Well, on the cover of your first book, and also smaller copies mm-hmm. of the photo in your mm-hmm. other books, is a photograph of this young woman staring right into your eyes, the reader's mm-hmm. eyes. And you think, golly, she looks Asian. And you wonder, well, who is this person in the photograph?
Mm-hmm.
Because she seems to fit your description in your book of your protagonist so well. She mm-hmm. looks like the Amy Machado that you describe. Mm-hmm. Where did you find this model?
She's my granddaughter. And if it hadn't been for her and her brother Harrison, these characters would have never been created. I started thinking when they were young, when they were small, that it would be fun to grow them up and have them become characters in a novel. And the real life Amy and Harry, Harry's still in high school. Amy is living back east now. She's married and living her own life. But when I first began thinking about this series, I asked Amy if she would model for me, because even though I didn't have a publisher yet, I wanted something I could put up on my website. And when I was offered my contract and was asked for ideas for the cover, I said, well, I think maybe the first book should introduce the main protagonist, and I have a photo I can send you to give you an idea, thinking that they would have a sketch artist or something, you know, do something. And the response was, we want to use the photo. And I said, oh, okay. And she said, the publisher said, she's lovely, and we'd like her face to appear on every book in the series.
So the first book in your series is called Due for Discard, and there is Amy, the real-life Amy, mm-hmm. staring at us mm-hmm. with her beautiful long black hair, mm-hmm. with her Asian and Chinese, I'm assuming, just like in the story. Chinese. Amy is Chinese and Portuguese.
Yes, that's correct.
And so there is Amy. Well, speaking of that, too, your second book, I have had so many people, they walk by and see the cover of this book, and they stop and stare at it, because Amy's photograph is just down in the bottom part, mm-hmm. but the cover of your second book mm-hmm. has this horse staring down at this man lying in a
horse trailer.
That's right. So your covers are very well. Did you have input in that one?
I designed it. I directed it. I did it all. I didn't click the shot, but this horse,
you staged it.
I staged it, and my husband is an outdoor photographer. The dying cowboy is our son-in-law. And the horse and trailer belong to very dear friends of ours who go on horseback and mule riding trips up into the wilderness with us. And when I had the vision for that, I said, what do you think? And they said, come on, you know, and they are just thrilled with this horse, who in the book is called Game Boy, is the real horse's name is Huckleberry.
My guest is Sharon Owen. She goes by the pen name Sharon St. George. And I want to talk to you about your book, Due for Discord, where we are introduced mm-hmm. to your main mm-hmm. character, Amy mm-hmm. Machado. And I'd like you to read, if you would, mm-hmm. This is early in your book, where we learn about her ancestry and about her family, this character. And we also learn that from your descriptions of this fictional town of Timbergate, mm-hmm. that, boy, it sounds an awful lot like Reading. Because when you start out your description, it is really hot.
Anyone who knows Reading would definitely come to that conclusion.
So would you read a little bit from your novel, Due for Discard?
Due for Discard. I stood outside my car with both doors open to let the interior temperature drop to a safe level. August in Timbergate was often the hottest spot in the entire country, and I didn't look forward to my sweltering studio apartment with its temperamental swamp cooler. My budget was so tight, I would need to work several months at my new job before I could afford to move out of my grandparents' llama barn and rent an apartment of my own in town. In exchange for free rent, I did chores and watched the place for Amma and Jack while they were away on adventures involving Jack's career as an outdoor writer. Their Highland Ranch property was in Coyote Creek, a ranching community 8 miles east of Timbergate in the Cascade Range foothills.
Now, you're describing this area, which sounds like it's around mm-hmm. Reading, and you actually grew up in this area that you describe in your book. You know it well.
I do. I actually grew up in Red Bluff, but spent years and years living in Reading, so yes, and so it's very familiar to me, yes.
Okay, and then you introduce us to her father's mother, mm-hmm. so go ahead.
Okay. My petite and active Amma is my father's mother on the Portuguese side of the family. She and Grandpa Machado were divorced before I was born, and she's been married to Jack Highland ever since I can remember. When I was a baby, she asked my mother about the Chinese word for grandmother. Mom explained that the word for paternal grandmother is pronounced Amma, but it's sometimes confused with Amma, a devoted family servant similar to a nanny. Amma joked that either name fits, since she was frequently called into service as a nanny when both my parents were working. She's been our dual-purpose Amma ever since. She's She and tall, lanky Grandpa Jack love the outdoors and frequently hike with their llamas. They're in their early 70s, but I can't see any signs that age has slowed them down.
Now, you mentioned llamas here, mm-hmm. and you, in fact, you grew up with horses, not with llamas.
I did, yes.
But you now are familiar with llamas.
Very much so. My husband and I started packing with llamas, gosh, it must be 15 years now. We've been through several llamas. The first two llamas were given to us, and it turned out they were really beyond the age when they could pack easily. So,
because my understanding is, because I lived in Peru where there are a lot of llamas.
Oh, you did?
And yeah, and they don't carry a heavy load. You can't load up a llama with a heavy weight, as far as I understand.
You know, it's interesting that you had to ask about that, because the llamas, depending on their size, but most llamas can carry, some people do more, but I would never put more than 80 pounds. And you have the panniers on each mm-hmm. side of the llama, and they have to be balanced exactly. You have to measure and weigh those panniers so that when they sit on the llama's back, the weight is equally distributed on both sides so that the llama doesn't become uncomfortable or the packs don't slide from one side to another. But we don't pack ours that heavily. Mm-hmm. For just the two of us, we just put in what we would need to spend a night or two up in the wilderness and mm-hmm. not have to carry it all on our backs.
So. Well, now, when I was up in the Andes, I saw llama trains, but I never mm-hmm. got close. Mm-hmm. And you know why I didn't want to get close?
Oh, you thought they'd spit?
I heard they might.
Well, you
in
know.
In fact, early in your you open your book with your main character mm-hmm, mm-hmm. having to deal with llama spit.
And my llama friends, when they saw that, the people who've read the book who have llamas said, oh, they said, they were worried when I opened until I then explained that this llama was startled out, you know, and that's not normal. You don't just walk up to a llama and have it decide to spit at you, except if you adopt a llama who has not been raised properly, like one whose name I will not mention right now that we're trying to break. Out of all the llamas we've ever had, this is the only one who has threatened to spit at us, and we're working now to train that out of him. But they will spit at each other. They're very odd in that way. They want a pasture pal, but they're very protective of personal space. And so it's llamas who live together sort of have love-hate relationships. It's interesting
like
stuff.
Well, after you introduce us to Amy's grandparents, you then introduce her brother. And mm-hmm. this is on page 11, that after she's dealt with the interior of her car being so hot, mm. and she heads home, and she calls her brother. So would you pick up and
okay.
read that paragraph?
I will. After a few minutes, the interior temperature of my car had dropped to a level I could tolerate. But instead of heading home, I called Harry and told him I was on my way to his condo with Mexican takeout and wine. I wanted his perspective on the doctor's missing wife. Harry isn't just my little brother. He's my very best friend. At 26, he's 2 years younger than I am and already making his fortune designing and constructing commercial buildings. He's a lefty with an ambidextrous brain. I think that gives him an edge. He decided on dual majors in architectural engineering and business when he was in the eighth grade, finished high school in 2 years, and college in three. What makes me most proud is that he hasn't let his success as a boy wonder architect or his reputation as a playboy go to his head.
Mm-hmm. This is mystery writer Sharon St. George. That's her pen name. Her name is Sharon Owen. And she is reading from one of her Amy Machado mystery novels. And we have just met Amy's brother, who has a nice description, and probably some of that is taken from, because there's a real-life person named Harry.
There is. He's quite a bit younger than the fictional Harry, so I've taken quite a few liberties. In fact, the real Harry, the Harrison's uncle, said to me, you really set that boy with a lot to live up to.
Because you say when he's in his eighth grade, he's already interested mm-hmm. in what he wants to do when he grows
that's
up.
Right. That's
that
right.
That he was interested in architectural mm-hmm. engineering and business when he was just in the eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is going to be a boy wonder no matter what he does. So I'm not too far off the mark that way.
You bring to your story actual information that was gleaned when you were actually a director in a hospital, and you are director of medical staff services?
That's the title now. Back in the day when I was working in that position, we were fortunate enough that they finally quit calling that job medical staff secretary and began to call it medical staff coordinator. It is now considered, it is now called Director of Medical Staff Services, because as women have progressed in the professional world, they've gained respect in many ways, including sometimes their job titles. So that's...
Well, those are words. We understand the individual words, but what does that staff do? What does that services, what does that agency do?
I'll try to keep this as brief as possible because this is a job. There's only one of these positions in each hospital. Each hospital has, and of course, this is a few years back, but I don't think the structure has changed dramatically. Each doctor who has privileges to admit you to a hospital must be a member of the hospital medical staff. That doesn't mean that they work for the hospital. It means that they're allowed to admit and treat patients there. That's called the medical staff organization. The Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals has lots of all kinds of strict rules about medical staff organizations. And the medical staff office, the person who's in charge of that, has to keep all of this straight and keep it all going and document everything and make sure that everything that organization is supposed to do happens. If not, when the accreditation team comes around, the hospital could lose its accreditation. And once that happens, they don't get Medicare payments. They don't get Medicaid payments. It's huge what will happen to that hospital if the medical staff organization isn't up to snuff when it's time to be accredited.
And you were director of these services, so you must have felt a pretty heavy weight on your shoulders.
Back when I was doing it, I think the burnout time was 3 years. Ooh. For that job. I was there 6.5 years. And that was long enough. But when I left the hospital, I realized that I had an insight into things that most people aren't aware is going on.
And the hospital might not want us to be aware of it.
Well, I don't think they would go out of their way to invite us to, you know, explain it to the general public, but there's a lot that's going on inside that hospital to try to keep patients safe. And the medical staff organization has a huge role to play in that. I remember I used to go to, there were almost 20 meetings a month of different committees that made up this medical staff organization. There was a surgery committee, there was an internal medicine committee, there was a radiology committee, and it just goes on and on. If I tried to list them all, we'd run out of time. But and then there was a hierarchy where what these committees would do, in addition to other things, is review every death and complication that occurred in the hospital. All of those charts had to be pulled. They had to be assigned to people on the committee, to doctors on the committee who had the privilege to review those cases. Then they would all have to come to the committee meeting. It would go around the conference room. Everybody would give their opinion. Was this care appropriate? Does this doctor need to be put on notice that his care was not appropriate? How severe is the problem? Do his privileges need to be suspended? There are two kinds of privileges. First, you have to be allowed to admit patients, and then you have to be granted permission to perform certain procedures on that patient. And every single one of those has to pass through the credentials committee and the what they call the medical staff executive committee and the governing board before that doctor is allowed to admit patients and care for them. So it's a huge, like I say, we could be here all day talking about that.
My guest is Sharon Owen. She writes under the name Sharon St. George. And her book, her first in her series of mystery novels, is due for a discard. And the reason she knows so much about the hospital is that she was director of medical staff services at a hospital. And you began writing the first hospital-based mystery while you were still a university student. And when you, this was in Connecticut, actually, mm-hmm. when you got back to California, you worked in a college library, mm-hmm. say, and so you were going to write the story about a hospital librarian.
Yes.
And it turns out that your protagonist was more than just a librarian, because that might sound, well, a librarian, how interesting is a librarian?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what does your protagonist do?
Well, she's doing more and more all the time. She's been getting duties added to her original job. But when she was first hired, the man who was instrumental in getting her hired had an idea for a consortium of forensic collection that would be available to all of the North State law enforcement and hospitals, because from Timbergate up to the Oregon border, there was such a lack of forensic materials and resources. So he thought, okay, let's hire a librarian. We need to fill this slot anyway. Let's find someone who has taken a course, the library course that involves forensic collections, which Amy had done. So that was kind of her, lucky for her, that's what they wanted. She wanted to be back in her hometown, and so that's how she got hired. So what she's doing in the first book, in addition to just generally taking care of the library and helping people know how to find the resources they need, she's setting up this consortium throughout the North State to make up-to-date forensic collections available not only to hospitals but to law enforcement agencies. And I did my own research on that, and I called around and discovered that this is a real-life issue. I've even had people say, that's such a wonderful idea. I wish you could make it happen. And that's not the only time that's ever happened to me when I write. That's what makes writing so exciting.
Because even though you write fiction, it could be true. You don't
yes.
write anything that could not be
I
true.
I do not, and that's just me. But, I mean, people love fantasy. They love science fiction. But for me, there's so much interesting out there that really could be true. That's where my passion lies.
Yeah. So. Well, in your photograph, in your first book, you have your main character there holding a book that says the forensic casebook.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives us a clue, too. And over mm-hmm. her shoulder, there's a bookshelf
right, right.
that says crime scene investigation and forensics.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a clue right there in the photograph mm-hmm. as to what this person's job might involve,
right,
that she works
right.
with forensics.
Yes.
Your book, Due for Discard, then, what does that title mean?
When you work in a library, every so often you go through and you purge the collection, and you get the statistics that tell you this book has been in the collection for 25 years. It has not moved. No one has checked it out. It's kind of just dead in the water. So let's purge it out of the collection. Let's discard it. And so when that's going on, you'll see these cardboard boxes with these big, you know, markers saying due for discard. And so I thought, well, what if the victim in the story was due for discard? I wanted to try to tie all of my titles in with something that could be medical or library related. And the first two, this one has the library term.
Mm-hmm.
This one, breach of ethics.
The second not, one,
I'm
see,
checked out, obvious. That's obvious. That's hospital and library.
And library, yeah.
And then the third book, I wasn't able to make that happen. It was a breach of ethics. But the fourth book is spine damage. And, of course, spine damage.
Books get spine damage. Humans get spine damage.
The last two, I can't think off the top of my head, because the second contract that I signed, they wanted me to give them a little brief synopsis of what mm-hmm. books 4, 5, and 6 would be, and I gave them the titles. I managed to find two more titles that were like checked out, that were hospital and library related, but it's not coming to me right now.
Well, I mentioned that you have three in a series already completed.
Yes.
So your publisher says, okay, Sharon, we want you to write three in this series of Amy Machado mysteries. You've done that. You've completed mm-hmm. three. And you mentioned your fourth book. So mm-hmm. your publisher said, yeah, we like these. Let's do three more.
That's right.
So that's your mm-hmm. what you're currently working on.
That's right.
Your fourth one. So you already have some titles.
I do. The fourth book, as I said, is Spine Damage, and one of, I think, Renewal is the name of one, and Primary Source is the name of the other one. The Primary Source is has to do with organ transplant mystery.
Well, I would like you to read a little bit more from your first novel. Okay. And later on in your book, maybe you'd like to set this up. This is in chapter 17. And would you like to set this up for us?
Oh, this is where Amy is in her Barntop apartment, and she hears a commotion.
And you might remind listeners that she's living at her grandparents' barn.
Right, she's in the
barn.
Living in the
Llama farm.
Right, the llama farm, the former bunkhouse that's now her little studio apartment over the barn. And she hears a commotion, and it startles her because her cat is howling and ferociously, and so she gets up to see what's going on. She doesn't have a whole lot of she's not sure what kind of weapon she needs, but she's in fairly short supply there. I think she says that I took a little hammer from the kitchen drawer and hung it in the waistband of my shorts. That and my flashlight were the only weapons I could come up with. Pitifully armed and pulsing with adrenaline, I turned on the outside light to illuminate the deck. Nothing showed through the peephole, so after a couple of deep breaths, I opened the door and nearly screamed. Lying motionless in an elongated S shape just outside my door was a rattlesnake, a big sucker no less than 2.5 feet long with at least 8 rattles.
So this character now is living out on in this barn apartment,
mm-hmm.
and this is some of what she encounters when she's living out mm-hmm. there. So I think that might be a suspenseful point mm-hmm. to say we're going to take a short break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I want to hear more about this first novel, Due for Discard. I also want to talk to you about your second novel. And so in this Amy Machado mystery series. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and my guest is mystery writer Sharon Owen. She writes under the pen name Sharon St. George. She's already written 3 books in this Amy Machado mystery series. She's currently writing a 4th. And you were describing the fact that she lives out in this, your main character, Amy,
mm-hmm.
Lives out in a barn apartment on her grandparents' property.
Yes.
And she is a forensic librarian, 2 words you don't usually hear combined, but that's who your main character is.
It's a real profession, but it was interesting that I did some research and discovered that there are, if you use the title correctly and professionally, I was told by a forensic librarian up in Washington State that there are only 3 in the country who are actually forensic librarians, which is far beyond the amount of beyond her position. But we're calling her that informally for the sake of the stories. But
she has these adventures, but she is living out there. But you also have a group in Reading, and I want to talk to you more about your second novel, but there's a group called Writers Forum in Reading.
Yes.
And you are the director, the program director for
this
group?
I am the program director, yes.
And what does that entail?
Well, we started back in the, early to mid-80s. There were enough people interested in writing that we were just meeting together informally. And as the group grew and developed, we went after and were granted nonprofit status as a 501c3 organization, which we've held for over 20 years now. This group is still going strong. It has evolved as computer and internet have evolved. We have a website, of course, and we have a board of directors of 10, and we meet every second Saturday of the month. And as program director, I try to present a variety of different sorts of writers' topics. Sometimes we have speakers, sometimes we have workshops. This month, the second Saturday, we have a panel of 5 children's and young adult writers, two of whom live in the Reading area, but the other 3 are all traveling from out of town to come, and they are all members of a wonderful organization called the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which is commonly referred to as SCBWI, but it's nationwide. And so they'll be coming up and doing a 4-hour presentation where they'll discuss issues pertinent to that genre, and then they'll break our attendees into groups and give them closer hand one-on-one advice about their projects. But we keep a very broad, as broad a spectrum as we can of writers' interests, so that we serve every writer in our membership.
Well, one thing I didn't mention in your background is that you have degrees in English and theater arts.
Yes.
And that would lead me to believe that you're interested in theater. And in fact, in the past, you acted and directed at Reading's Riverfront Playhouse.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you won Best Actor role.
I did. It's funny. They talk about this was before the term bucket list came out, but I had my own little list. And on my list, I won't go into it for lack of time, but one of the things on my list was that I would like to win the Best Actor Award at Riverfront Playhouse. Right after I came home from New York and moved back to California with my minor in theater arts, I was asked to audition for a wonderful play called The Road to Mecca by Athol Fugard. And after I read the script, I desperately wanted to play the main character. She's a South African woman, one of the Boer, the German ancestry who settled in South Africa. And her story, just maybe that's it, the women's theme getting to me again. She was older, she lived alone, and the pastor in her church was telling her, it's time for you to leave your home and go into a retirement or a nursing home. And that's the whole story, is about her struggle around that.
And you won an award for your role that's in The Road to Mecca. And then you also directed, and you got a Best Director Award for co-directing The Diary of Anne Frank.
Yes, and I credit most of that to my fellow director, because she was more experienced than I was. But I learned so much, and it was a wonderful experience to direct that play. It's so, again, so meaningful, and another woman's story, you know.
But I do know personally that it's very time-consuming. It's wonderful and it's fun, but theater work demands a huge time commitment.
Yes, it is.
So you aren't actively doing that now, but who knows?
I'm not able to
right now. You're writing. Now you also, speaking of awards, had communication with an Oscar winner, an Oscar-winning screenplay writer.
That's right.
How did that come about?
I wrote a paper when I was back in school as a returning student for a wonderful course called Women Writers with a wonderful professor that I just can't say enough about her. But when it came time to choose a paper to write, we'd studied Jane Austen. We'd studied all of the wonderful women writers. And she and I talked about a topic. And she said, you know, everybody knows Pride and Prejudice, but nobody ever talks about Sense and Sensibility. She said, why don't you write a paper about Sense and Sensibility? And so I said, oh, okay, I'll look into that. And she said, you know, this was a very patriarchal society back when Jane Austen was writing. So I ended up with my paper, title being Restrictions of Women in the Patriarchal Society of Jane Austen. My professor asked me if she could submit that paper for the annual top literary paper award at that university, and I said, of course. Then I received—
And this was in Connecticut.
This was in Connecticut, school. Yes. And I received a notice saying, oh, you need to come to the award ceremony. And I said, well, why? And they said, oh, well, just come. And so I thought, what? By that time, I was thinking, what is this about? But I had won the top award for that literary paper. And sometime later, my husband at the time, who was interested in theater and in acting, spotted a notice that Emma Thompson was writing the screenplay to Sense and Sensibility. And what pleased me the most was, well, there's two of us who were interested in that particular novel. So he said, you know, I can get you in touch with her agent, and you could ask if she might like to see your paper. So we
she
did
meaning
that.
Emma Thompson.
She meaning Emma Thompson, yes. And so we did that. I reached her literary agents, who said, oh, yes, send it. She'd love it. And so I did. And a few weeks later, I was actually at school rehearsing for a play that I was in, and called home to see what was going on. And my husband said, he just couldn't stand it. He said, you have a letter here, and I just know it's from Emma Thompson. Can I open it?
And it was, in fact, Emma Thompson wrote you back a personal letter in her very own handwriting.
Yes, she did.
Doesn't get better than that.
It doesn't get better than that. And then she won the award for the Oscar for that screenplay. And so that's my claim to fame story about Emma Thompson.
My guest is Sharon Owen, and she writes under the name Sharon St. George. She writes Amy Machado mystery stories. She so far has written three. The first, Due for Discard, and the second, Checked Out. And you have a website, and it reminds me of the way, if you rent a movie now, they show you the movie, but then there are bonus. Mm. There's a supplement that gives you kind of background for it. And so your website is kind of like that. For example, this Checked Out. Mm-hmm. On your website, you have a blurb about it's not a good idea for our patients to check themselves out of a hospital.
That's
they
right.
can do it, but it's not recommended.
That's right.
And the letters for this is AMA, and it's not American Medical Association, no. American Music Awards. What does, in the hospital context, what does AMA stand for?
It stands for Against Medical Advice. And there's a specific procedure that's supposed to be followed when a patient decides they want to leave the hospital before they're officially discharged. What it involves, I won't go into all the detail, but it involves a form that has to be signed by the patient and witnessed by hospital staff, the nurse at least, if not the doctor, because legally, it's very important legally that paper be signed if the patient wants to leave, particularly when the doctor is saying, no, it's not safe for you to leave yet. You need to stay in. So it's just, that's what it means, against medical advice. Yeah.
You give the example that there's this series, Sherlock Holmes, and you probably are a fan of Sherlock Holmes since you like to write mysteries.
Yes.
And in one of the episodes, he decides he gets mad and wants to check himself out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, but he's got to sign a form.
No, not if he's Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock, they did another boo-boo that I wrote about in on my website under the blog Writers, Do You Know What You Don't Know? And poor Sherlock's getting a hard time from me. I guess I hadn't realized I'd done two, but they used the term cordite in a smell of gun firing. Well, it turns out cordite hasn't been used in 70 years. And this Sherlock was the present day Sherlock who made reference to, oh, I knew that such and such because I smelled the cordite. And
Oh, and right away you said, no.
Well, you know, mystery writers have this lovely advantage. There's an email group called Crime Scene Writers, and many of its members are law enforcement people, medical people, forensic people. And one of the fellows in particular, I won't say his name, but every time he spots or hears somebody use cordite, he rants. He kind of rants about it. So knowing about cordite, when I heard that, it was just like somebody clanged a big bell in my ears. You know, it's like, he said cordite.
and this was the modern day Sherlock,
as opposed to the original Sherlock. Modern day, yes.
And you also mentioned, I mean, he is in London after all, so maybe there they don't have to sign that form that you...
Oh, no, the modern day one is in New York.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In London, you said that when he checked himself out of the hospital, it may be London, maybe they have different rules.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe. So, the thing is, probably... I would assume that there are probably quite a few people who aren't really familiar with hospitals or haven't had any experience with it who don't even know that there's a procedure. They just get up and leave without knowing that somebody needs to document that they've taken it upon themselves to refuse further treatment. So, yeah.
My guest is Sharon Owen, and she writes under the name Sharon St. George, the first in her Amy Machado mystery series, due for discard. And the second one is Checked Out. And in your book, who is checked out?
Well, this is back to against medical advice, actually, because this cowboy who's severely wounded on the cover had already been in the hospital before this situation came about. And he checked him. He left. His nurse...
This is
backstory for... This happens mm-hmm. before this story actually begins. And then you hear about it after the fact. But he did the same thing. He left the hospital, but he left because he was so afraid that someone was after him and that if he were in the hospital and went through the surgery that he was supposed to have, that he would be so vulnerable that even in the hospital that someone might get to him and finish him off. So he wanted to get out of that setting and get out of town, even though he was he had an injury in a very private part of his body that needed to be corrected. And
he wanted to get out before he had to have that surgery.
Well, that was originally part of it too. Was he worried about the surgery or why did he leave? Because they didn't know in the beginning that there was another reason.
Well, the characters in your book include the main character, Amy Machado, mm-hmm. who is the forensic librarian at mm-hmm. this medical center called Timbergate, mm-hmm. which is a fictional representation, really, of Reading. It's kind of clear that this is Reading,
it's hard to deny it in front of locals.
But then you also have characters in there that, because Amy's a young woman, mm-hmm. and so you have romantic interest for mm-hmm. Amy, your main character.
Yes.
And one of them is her boss, and she has been warned. I think it was her grandmother said, Amy, mm-hmm. be careful. Mm-hmm. Don't date your boss.
Right. He is pretty hunky, though.
Yeah, you have nice descriptions of the men in your book. Mm. But Amy does have this guy that she has mm-hmm. had this on and off again relationship, so we don't know, is this going to work out? Are they going to work mm-hmm. things out or not? Mm-hmm. You also have in this, I believe it's in this book, you have Amy and this boyfriend, sometimes mm-hmm. on and off again boyfriend, go to track down a witness to a murder. They go off on a llama pack.
That's right. Nick and Amy, they end up in the wilderness with the llamas. And it was just fun to write that in because it's something I've lived, really. And it was just like being there, you know, to write that to write those chapters. So
you can have your character have adventures that you are familiar with yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, you happened to have written a young adult Western, didn't you, in your past?
It was never published, but it was kind of what I cut my teeth on because I was still working at the hospital, and I knew better than to try to write a hospital mystery while I was working in a hospital because, sure enough, true or not, everyone I knew who knew anything would be trying to figure out who I was writing about. And so I was like, I'm not going there, you know.
So in your second book, Checked Out, you do get to write about a cowboy. It's been such fun talking to you about your mysteries, Sharon.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Sharon Owen, and she has a series of mystery novels. She's written three so far, Due for Discard, Checked Out, and her latest, Breach of Ethics.
Yes.
And the fourth one also. We'll look forward to seeing it.
Retired English teacher Marianne Werner got a B.A. in English from San Diego State University, an M.A. in Creative Writing from Syracuse University, and a J.D. from the University of San Diego. She taught high school English and American government for 25 years. She taught English at Butte College for 13 years. Some of her poems, essays, and travel pieces have been published nationally and locally, for example, in the Chico News and Review and the Chico Enterprise Record. She is a traveler and tries to preserve the moments worth remembering in photos or in poems. She published a collection of poems and nature photos called Simple Images. Because she is a reader, loves language and story, I've invited her to tell us about a book of fiction and a book of nonfiction that she would recommend. Marianne Werner, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's always difficult for a book reader to have to narrow the choices down, but I've made the effort.
You know, I imagine it's like asking a parent, what is your favorite child?
Right. Yeah. We have a few more choices with the books, but...
Oh, yeah.
And it's not going to hurt anybody's feelings, so I'm going to give you a couple of choices for me.
Sure.
The first is a nonfiction book that... I discovered, actually, a gentleman at the gym recommended it, and it had been read by another friend of mine in town, John Sade, who's a local photographer and musician, and it's called H's for Hawk, and it's a nonfiction book by Helen MacDonald, and it is one of the most beautifully written books that I've ever read, and it is also a book where, as an English teacher, we're always looking at language and trying to determine what word could fit or what word doesn't fit or what has to go in this, it's just no good. But there was almost nothing in this book that I would have changed. I mean, the language was so precise and so profound. And it's a very powerful story because it's about some kind of a researcher in Oxford, I believe. I'm not positive about that. But she's working in England and doing research. And she's always had a thing for birds since the time she was very young. And the idea of training a hawk has always been of interest to her, and she's been involved in wild birds, and her father dies unexpectedly. She's very close to her father. And this is a journey of reconciling grief with a very brutal part of the natural world because this hawk, it's actually a goshawk that she ends up training, named Mabel, causes her to confront herself in terms of her emotional state, which is she's profoundly, profoundly grief-stricken and depressed. And everywhere she turns, she sees her father. And so she undertakes to train this hawk. And the relationship that develops between the two of them and what is involved in the intensity and the passion with training this animal is very powerful.
Well, you know, I know this is a recent book. I have not read it, but I do know people who just think it's a wonderful book, and it is a recent book.
It is a recent
and
book.
And it sells well, and so I've been curious as to what the appeal is of this book. And you're just saying on every level.
I think on every level, and she ends up... It's kind of an interesting mixture of myth and mythology and history. She talks about T.H. White, who wrote The Once and Future King. He attempted to do this, and he had a chronicle of the goshawk that he wrote about, and she constantly was going back to what he did. And he was not very successful because these birds essentially are trained to relate to you in such a way that you are the being that they're completely dependent upon. And this is a wild animal. It's a feral animal. And she ended up, I think, going to Ireland or Scotland to get this bird. And she begins to train it, and the ultimate goal is to release the animal and have it return. Well, when you practice with an animal like that, you don't necessarily know whether it's coming back. And there were many, many times when she just traversed running across the fields in such a way that she came back bloody and messed up because she was trying to find this bird and didn't know if it would come back.
I might remind listeners that I'm talking to Marianne Werner. She's a retired English teacher, and she's telling us about a work of nonfiction because it sounds like a story that could be fiction, Marianne.
It sort of does, but it's very powerful in its own way of just the utter inability to comprehend that her father is gone and an inability to reconcile that. And so she enmeshes herself with this wild animal to try somehow to work through the grief that accompanied her father's death and along with this very challenging kind of activity with this hawk.
I'll bet it makes you wish you were still teaching so you could have your students read this book.
Yeah, I would absolutely use this book in the classroom, absolutely. And I've read it twice now.
Oh, really?
And both times for... the first on my own, and then I'm in two book groups, and we read it in one of the book groups. And in a very unusual reaction, everyone liked it. And almost no one in a book group likes every book.
100%.
100%. This was 100%er, I think. So I would absolutely recommend that one. Absolutely.
Well, you know, you taught English both to high school students and to college students, and yet you have a law degree.
I do have a law degree.
And it sounds like it came in handy if you taught American government.
It did come in handy, and I think it probably made me a better thinker. But I don't know. I don't think I could have been a lawyer. I think I would have said, Your Honor, he did it. He did it.
You mean you'd tell the truth, Marianne?
I would tell the truth.
Oh,
and I'm sure that's probably not the way to be very successful as a lawyer, although I'm sure there are many truthful lawyers out there. It's not about the truth. It's about the system.
My guest is retired English teacher Marianne Werner, and she has published a collection of poems and nature photographs called Simple Images. And she's telling us about a work of nonfiction that she has read and that has been very popular with readers. It's been at the top of the bestseller list and the end of the year favorites in that list of books. And
absolutely,
your book club.
Yeah.
Have liked it as well. Anything else that you think we should know about this book, H is for Hawk?
I'd
tell the title again in case people missed
that. H is for Hawk. I prefer not to give too much away, except that it is it's a moving experience. It's not just a book that you read and forget. Mm-hmm. It's really because her grief is so profound that. She eventually gets some help for medical help because she's so obsessed. She becomes absolutely obsessed with this animal, absolutely obsessed. And she is, interestingly, she is a scientist, essentially, and she's also an artist in her creativity. So that blend of personality along with what she's faced with is a very hard journey for her, but it's a wonderful
And
following.
Tell us the name, H is for Hawk, and the author is?
Helen MacDonald.
Helen MacDonald. So if you haven't yet read the book, I'm talking to the listeners now, I'm sure there are book lovers out there who would be interested in reading this book now that you have told us more about it.
Lots of stars after this one.
It's a five-star novel.
A five-star plus, yeah.
H is for Hawk by, again?
Helen MacDonald.
Helen MacDonald. Now, you also said you have a recommendation as in fiction.
I do have a recommendation in fiction, and again, I've read this one a couple of times, and it is a book called Cutting for Stone that came out several years ago. It's been around for a while, but when Nancy asked me to do this, I went to my bookshelf. I wasn't sure what book I was going to choose, and I started going through all the books in my library, and when I got to this one, I stopped immediately because I knew that this was just a powerful book. It is written by Abraham Verghese, who is he's actually a doctor himself.
Medical doctor.
He's a medical doctor, and the last I heard, he was at Stanford, somewhere in the Bay Area, and he also has a master's in creative writing from the University of Iowa. So this is a book called Cutting for Stone, and its title is rather unusual in that part of the Hippocratic Oath that a doctor takes is has a direct quote from it, and it is said, and it says, "Thou shalt not cut for stone." And what that means is essentially that it's interpreted several ways, but one of the meanings historically was that doctors were not supposed to cut patients who they knew would not live through the surgery, and they were also to refer them to specific people who were trained more to be surgeons. And this is a novel about twin boys who were born in Ethiopia to a nun and a surgeon, and the mother dies in childbirth and the father disappears. And it's about their life as surgeons, and it's about the healing arts. And it is about a problem in that part of the world that is something that, that most of us don't know anything about. And in fact, it inspired me to do something that I'll mention in just a minute. But it's an absolutely remarkably written book. It is a narrative story that's a very compelling story because there are very intricate relationships. As I say, the father disappears. These sons are very close, but they part ways. There's betrayal, deceit, there's love, there's all kinds of things. But
my guest, I might remind people, Marianne Werner, a retired English teacher. She taught high school English. She taught English at Butte College. And I've asked her to tell us about a book of fiction that she would highly recommend. And what? Tell us again the title and the author of this book.
The title is Cutting for Stone, and the author is Abraham Verghese.
And what is it that appeals to you, that why you recommend this book so highly?
Well, I think it has to do with the story. And I'm one who is kind of inclined to let language trump story. Uh-huh. So if the language is good enough in a book, I'm going to overlook some of the elements of story. And if the story is good enough, language is important to me, but I can be a little forgiving. But this book combines those. It has characters that you're going to be compelled to want to follow. And it deals with a problem in Africa, which is very much a contemporary problem that has to do with fistulas in women after they've given birth and the number of women who die in childbirth because there is not adequate medical care for women. And if they have that problem, they're ostracized in their communities. And there's a Through reading this book, I have come in contact with and become a supporter of a fistula foundation in San Francisco that has set up hospitals all over Africa and India to help women. And once they're after they have babies, after that kind of repair is made to them, they are able to go back home and have children again, as opposed to being ostracized when there was no surgery. But that's a theme through this book of what the healing arts do and what they don't do. And one of the quotations that one of the sons become surgeons. It's really three different surgeons, both of the twins and the father. And the boy recounts a story of being with his father who's trying to determine whether or not to operate on someone. And the person is going to die if the young man thinks if his father doesn't operate, he will die. And the father tells him, well, one of the rules of being a surgeon is thou shalt not operate on the day someone's going to die. So you have to know about your patients. So it's about that relationship between the patient and the doctor and what the healing arts really, really are.
Well, tell us one more time this title of the fiction book that you're recommending.
Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese.
And before we wrap up, I know you love to travel, and where are you going next, Marianne?
I'm hoping to go to Madagascar in 2016.
Thank you so much for coming in and telling us about your favorites, fiction and nonfiction books.
Thank you, Nancy.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, Sharon Owen, who writes under the name Sharon St. George. She's author of the Amy Machado Mystery Series. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, MyNSBR.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.